This is the Amp Hour Podcast, recorded March 31st, 2015. Episode 243 with Chris and Parker from MacroFab. Macro, manufacturing, mechanization.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
And I'm Chris Church.
And Parker Doman
of MacroFab.
That was a very professional introduction, guys.
Yeah. Welcome. Very nice. I would like these guys to do other things that take organization and like putting together boards for me, Dave.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know you were still in that business, Chris.
Oh. April Fools? I don't know. we were talking about April Fools jokes before the show. I don't know how we were going to work that in, but
well, they just did.
Yeah, I guess that was it. So
we need to make sure to slow his order down.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So tell us all about MacroFab. What do you guys do?
We are a new kind of contract manufacturer that's focused on agile electronics manufacturing for hardware startups and makers.
Should people get their bingo cards out now? You've already mentioned the word agile.
Yeah. I like the word personally. I try to fit it in every sentence. But.
Because I see on your website here, I'm browsing through, as I scroll down, you've thrown in holistic approach, and you've thrown in just-in-time production.
Oh, I didn't see this.
Mm-hmm.
Compliance. Oh, yeah.
Compliance.
Fulfillment.
That's important.
This is all bread and butter stuff for contract manufacturers, right?
Are you guys ISO certified yet? That's usually CMs like talking about ISO too. So.
No, we're working on that, but okay. I wouldn't even want to talk about that. Yeah. It's pretty painful.
Yeah,
we have a process that's pretty similar. We're just not certified yet because that's a lot of paperwork.
Yep, exactly.
Now, let's get this clear up front. Do you guys actually do the contract assembly and stuff yourself, or are you just a facilitator service as such?
We do the assembly in-house. The
Excellent.
Only thing that comes out of house right now is the PCBs themselves.
Right.
And we're working on solving that problem too.
You're Ooh. Looking at making your bare boards in-house?
Eventually, yes.
Yeah, we want to. That's the only way to get it even faster is to.
I was going to say, does it pay you to do that, or is it just a matter of speed?
Just
speed. Yeah.
Speed? Right.
Yeah. Making PCBs is not a highly profitable proposition.
No, I was going to say,
a lot of chemicals and crappiness.
But it's very messy. It's a
very
messy business. I mean, assembly's messy enough, but. Mm-hmm. Like, you're taking it to a whole new order of magnitude.
I think what
messier.
You guys want to do is convince someone to open one in the space next door. That's what you really
right.
want to do.
That would be great.
Yeah. So anyone who's looking, Chris and Parker will help you find a space nearby, which is in Houston. So tell us, why Houston? Why are you guys in Houston?
Well, this is where we're from.
Yeah, I was born here in Houston, and that's where me and Chris met.
Sorry,
so.
I'm picturing a 44-gallon hat and a... and a six shooter
Dave
with a
Texas.
Quick draw. I'm sorry. I just,
to be fair, they only hold 5 gallons.
Right.
and we only wear cowboy boots on weekends.
Except me.
Got it. With spurs.
Yeah. Static spurs or anti-static spurs.
Static spurs.
Anti-static spurs.
Well, that's how we get conductivity to the ground.
Yeah. Right. That's what they're for. Jesus. No wonder. You have like a little soldering iron on your hip. You're like, draw.
Six shooter soldering iron.
There you go, yeah.
But this is a great place to have a manufacturing company. I mean, if you look around, there are actually a number of EMS companies here, electronics manufacturing
right.
services. We got about 30 in town.
Really? Okay.
But there's so much oil for
this. We don't have 30 in the whole country. So is it a cheap place to do business? Is it a cheap place to, rent big spaces and things like that? Or
Out of all the big cities in the States, it's one of the cheapest and inexpensive to run a business in.
Well, they like to tell us that, they're
right,
always...
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the state doesn't have any business taxes either, right?
So that, oh, no,
I
they
mean,
do.
That...
They do.
Yeah, there,
oh,
there
they
are.
Do?
Yeah, it's a...
Or is it income taxes? There's no state income taxes. That's what it is.
Well, yeah, what we have for the business, we have the franchise tax, which is effectively a business tax, and then property tax. So
right.
Those will get you.
Yeah.
So would it be advantageous for your business to... be in any other state? I wouldn't think so, because it's all mail order business, right? Essentially, it's all sort of remote business. You could be anywhere, couldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, as long as we're within a couple of days delivery of any major area where our customers are in the country, I don't see any benefit to being anywhere else.
Yeah, as long as the rent's not astronomically high,
right?
That's only detriment living somewhere else.
Right. Because a lot of startup companies do make that mistake. Oh, we've got to be in California, we've got to be in Silicon Valley, and they get there, and their company folds because they can't afford the rent.
Yeah, the rent and cost of living.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, we pay for our space here. We're in downtown Houston, and, we pay probably a tenth of downtown office space in San Francisco.
A tenth.
Yeah.
Well, San Francisco, that's like comparing to the highest.
Well, yeah, true, but still.
But that's still nice for downtown. Like, yeah, downtown, that is impressive, though. I mean, Houston is, if people don't know, Houston is huge. Like, the outer rings, especially, are just, like, monstrous. So that's impressive, too, that you're downtown. I mean, is there a benefit to being downtown versus out, like, in the burbs area?
Well, it's kind of... It's central for all of our employees. It's also closer to my house, which is a key importance to me.
It's good to be king.
And I actually moved out from the burbs into central Houston to get closer to work. So,
And we have a couple unspoken benefits, or actually they're about to be spoken. We have a brewery right next door and a soccer stadium on the other side of us.
So, nice. Oh, that's awesome.
Soccer?
Yeah. The Houston
Dynamo. I didn't think you Yanks were into soccer.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, most of the people here at the office are pretty into soccer.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, I think a lot of the younger generations come up kind of playing soccer more, so that kind of helped to boost the MLS interest. I don't know. That's my assumption. We closest team to me is Columbus. So.
Yeah, you can't really help us to be here because this whole street, they rent out our parking lot for the games. So.
Oh, nice.
Right.
Yeah, people tailgate in the front of our warehouse.
Nice. Do you guys walk around like selling blinky things like out there during the
actually that would be a good idea.
Yeah, it's
totally
good to promote
stuff too. Little orange solder mask on there. We could make it.
Yeah, if you guys get like extra panel
Dynamo sues you.
Use it as like your panel filler space, right? So if you got extra panel, just do that.
That could be cool. Goodness. Now, setting up this potentially getting into the PCB manufacturing side of things. Let's get back to business. Mm-hmm. Would it be in any way advantageous to like spin off a company like Nextdoor, your own company that did that, or would you keep it under the one banner? Sorry, this is just the business side of me coming out.
No. Just considering the context in which we do it, it would make more sense just to do it under the same roof, under the same business. Our only goal in doing PCBs in-house is to do next day service. So we're able to, within 24 hours, turn the whole turnkey assembly over. And we would only be doing those 24-hour services in-house.
Yep. Because there's a slippery slope here. If you set up your own PCB manufacturing, bareboard manufacturing, then you can slide down that non-profitable slope of actually contracting those services out to and making bare boards to other people. And as you've said, there's not much money in that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And then just again, those environmental considerations here, people tend to think of Texas as a anti-EPA kind of state.
Yeah, that's my impression.
Don't mess with Texas, right, guys?
but here in Houston, and especially here in the downtown area, we're in a fairly highly regulated zone.
Right.
So we probably wouldn't be able to do sort of the mass scale you're used to seeing, the high chemical processes. We probably wouldn't even be able to do those here in the region where we're at right now.
Yeah,
what sort of process technology would you look at going for just like 4-layer tops, or would you stick to 2 layers or what?
For 24 hours, we probably would start with 2-layer only and do either lasering or CNC boards.
Oh, right. Cool.
Yeah, but we would still do the solder mask and all that. We'd still have that process and have properly plated vias and everything.
Huh.
Awesome.
So, okay, so that's for 24-hour stuff. I mean, so can you tell us more about the current generation? Like, what is a normal turn time?
Yeah, so our standard service is 15 business days, and that's what we call our low-cost service. So basically, if money is of your primary concern, that would be the service you'd choose. And we just today launched a 5-day turnaround service, which we believe is still less expensive than many of the standard options you have out there, but obviously has a higher cost due to the need to expedite the PCBs and the parts and everything.
Right. Okay.
Now,
so that's where
it should be
then.
Noted that you guys have what looks like, I haven't played with it much, but a fancy-pantsy online, technical terms here, fancy-pantsy online system that allows people to see, you know, to upload their design files, see their PCBs, like their Gerbers, how it's going to be assembled, the bill of materials, the placement, firmware, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Is this your secret sauce, so to speak?
That's part of it. We've actually built the technology all the way down to the line. So not only do we have that front end there, what that does, and there's actually a step in there where you can adjust the rotation of the parts on the PCB. And
right. So me, as the client, I can see that and say somebody has goofed that part up before you actually hit the go button on the assembly machine.
Exactly.
So I can double check it myself.
Absolutely. And that's kind
brilliant.
Of brilliant. We actually only let you do that for the most part.
Right. Okay. So the client has to sign off on it before press the go button.
Absolutely. They have to approve all the parts on there.
For those who aren't aware, that's not how regular contract manufacturing works. You sort of generally like throw it over the fence, give them all the files, and they're
the
ones who check
it
and set it up. Yeah, set up the pick and place machine and press go, and then you cross your fingers and hope the board comes out the other end with the parts in the right orientation and the right location.
Exactly. You
know? Right. So you guys have flipped that on its head.
Absolutely. And a lot of people don't realize, especially in the low volume, that's a huge contributor to the cost. To have
setup is everything.
Yeah, the trained engineer to sit there for an hour and a half to read your silk screens and program that machine, rotate this part that way. If you have silk screens,
And some people complain about, oh, it cost me a couple of $100 for setup. Are you kidding me? It's like, well, that's cheap, you know.
Yeah, I mean, for like when we have to set up that machine for long runs, I mean, it takes a couple hours for our operations guy to set it up. I mean,
that's for a simple board, right? Mm-hmm. If you've got a real complex board, it can take all day or even 2 days to set up a machine sometimes. If it's really complex.
Okay, so that's what we've done there is we've eliminated that upfront engineering cost by putting that back on the user. And that information you do and all that interaction you do through that user interface actually generates data for us on the back end. It tells us, for example, we know when you're changing parts around, so we're able to learn where we match parts incorrectly. But also, those adjusting the rotations eliminates that step, and therefore we can take the design direct to the machine. And further down from that, we still have a lot of hand assembly going on. Like, say, if you're doing a one-off of a device, and you're the only person in our queue right now that has this one chip on there, we're not going to spend 30 minutes programming the machine to do it. Someone's going to do that by hand. So we also have built an interface for our line workers where all that information flows down direct to them and it walks them through part by part on each job, what to place, where, how to validate that step and everything. And that gets our cost down substantially.
Did you guys have this idea from the get-go? Is this why you set up the business? Did you go, oh, look, this contract assembly sucks because you throw it over the wall. Let's build something that... Or did it come about, like, did you start it and then it come about, oh, geez, this would be a good idea? Did you slowly fall into it? How did that work?
It's a little bit of the former there. Previously, I had a small electronics company, and we were doing very well, but we were a very niche market product. And we were selling, our highest selling product was maybe 1,000 units a year. And in some products, we sell 5 or 10 units a year. And wow. I was constantly frustrated by the fact that, you know, I put in orders with these manufacturing houses and I just don't hear anything for months.
Yeah, of course you don't.
I mean, I hear anything
you want 10
loads? And what's worse is when you hear back from them, it's some arbitrary price and you're like,
yeah.
I had no idea where this bill of material just like astronomically is four times the price. Why is it that cost?
Because we said so. That's why.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you guys are a nothing business to us. Go away. You're annoying.
We're in control.
Yeah.
Prior to the electronics company, I actually had founded and was chief architect for a large-scale software as a service business, doing basically cloud-based technology. And I'm sitting here going, can't this all be much better? Can't this be a much better experience? Can't we give the customer more control here? And ultimately, I decided that was a lot more interesting of a problem than you know, selling niche market electronics at the time. So yep. I enlisted Parker. I said, let's go do this.
So how did you guys set it up? Because it takes a lot of coin to set up an assembly house. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, decent machines cost, you know, like a decent assembly loan is going to cost $500,000.
Yeah.
Well, it certainly does here, right?
Yeah.
It is expensive. Yes. What we did is, you know, we've had two angel rounds at this point.
Okay. Yep.
We raised the first in fall of 2013, and then the second in the beginning of 2014. And then what we did is we went out and scraped auctions and found equipment that would meet our needs.
Yeah.
And refurbished it.
Yeah, I spent probably a couple months refurbishing all the machines and making sure they were running really well.
Yep.
They're like old cars. They just need a little bit of TLC and they run fine.
Yep. Nice.
For a while.
For a while. And then you have
to do maintenance. Yeah. Right.
Was it hard to convince people to invest in a contract, a pretty much a commodity saturated market, which is contract
manufacturing.
Have you guys
heard of China? Yeah. We want to do that in the U.S.
You couldn't imagine how difficult it is.
I'm starting to, yeah.
Yeah, it's surprisingly difficult. You know, I mean, fortunately, though, I mean, what effectively we're building here is not a contract manufacturing company to compete with China.
Right.
You know, obviously, we have a much, much bigger vision. Otherwise, the investors wouldn't have had any interest.
Of course.
and we really see the manufacturing as a means to an end. So
what end is that?
Yeah, what is that? Yeah.
Well,
besides
know, really,
world domination.
Yeah, well, obviously, right?
Amazon 2.0.
We need a really big laser, and we need the money for the big laser. So
and the moon base.
Yep.
But no, what we're really focused on is what I wanted to do at my last company. I didn't want to be dealing with managing operations. I didn't want to be haggling with manufacturers all the time. I wanted to design cool products and sell them to people. So we're trying to enable startups and, you know, makers to actually bring their products completely to market, not just the PCB, but the entire package, you know, from the software that runs on it to the PCB design to the enclosure, the packaging, everything, getting that in the hands of the customers as easily, as quickly, and as inexpensively as possible so they can be out there designing new products and not worrying about all the challenge of actually, you know, what does it take to get this done? You know, which EMSs do I need? Which enclosure companies, et cetera?
How many people do I have to call, right?
Do you think this would have been as successful if it wasn't for the recent crowd funding craze where, you know, every man and his dog with an idea for a widget can just, you know, get $1 million and then go, right, how do I manufacture it? And then give it to someone like you.
Yeah, so no one would have invested in a business like this if it weren't for crowdfunding.
I was thinking that.
Yeah, I would say actually crowdfunding pretty much it really helps the small guys get their product out there and really enables a company like us to try to exist.
Mm-hmm. And on top of that, it's brought hardware into the mainstream up for the investors,
exactly.
The public. You know, now a little guy can bring a product to market. if they try really
with the
hard.
Help of you guys.
Yeah, exactly.
Can they? How many of your customers, you know, are the panicked? Oh my God! I just got $500,000 on Kickstarter. I don't know what to do. Help!
Usually we catch them before they get there.
Right. Yeah. So do you proactively go out and search crowdfunding campaigns and then email and then spam them?
No.
As I've gotten several times?
Yeah.
Sir.
We kind of make a point not to do that because I just, you know, it's not a very cost-effective strategy.
I'm going to put Dave on the mailing list.
Yeah.
Dave, you make Bluetooth speakers by chance? Because I always, maybe you want to make a Bluetooth speaker. Have you gotten those emails?
The worst are lists of features and they say how much.
Yeah, no.
Have you ever turned down anyone because you think that they're just scammers or their idea is just so shit it's not going to work and you don't want to be involved in it?
We don't turn them down. Generally, what we do is we like to use what we call price ability in this. So anything that we don't want to do, we just price it at a price that someone else doesn't want to pay.
Right.
That seems to be effective. It's better than saying no, right?
I don't want to turn away people, and I like to help people in their designs and stuff. So,
but some people are just idiots and need to be saved from themselves, right?
I wouldn't put it that way, but you're correct.
There's a high cost to involving yourself. How about we say it like that?
Yeah, that's the way we put it.
Yeah.
So we just charge what it's worth in that case, and usually we find it's not worth that much to them.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, I mean, Dave's asking about the kind of the prototype quantities, and it seems like this is very, very strong, like probably one of the strongest. You know, I think about you guys and then Small Batch and Circuit Hub. It's kind of like the group of like assembly with like some software front end versus kind of the traditional, the advanced circuits and those guys, like all the Sierra, all them, like everybody, you know, like those are kind of the options I think of. But I actually looked at the price on your example, and I do recommend people go to macrofab.net and then click on the what's the button, is it the it's
demo.
The demo button at the top, and basically it loads up a propeller development stick board, stuff like that. That was actually what sold me on it so far. I mean, I haven't had a chance to try it yet, but just the single board cost assembled for $52.50.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's crazy.
Insane.
Yeah.
Now, I then tried to drag it out to kind of more quantities. What are you guys, do you guys have a break-even point where you say, well, at a certain point, it doesn't really make as much sense for us, or, you know, then we have to incur different costs? Like, how do you guys see your split between single quantity, 100, 1,000? Million.
Right. So with that, generally at a certain point, everybody hits the same level of efficiency at a certain volume. And so what we find is that once you're getting into several thousand units in a single order, our pricing now starts to creep up enough relative to other, you know, small assembly companies that a lot of times it doesn't make sense to the customer.
Right.
Generally, we want customers that are below 1,000 units a month. That's really our sweet spot. Our software is much better at scheduling when we can get a job done in a few days versus, you know, dragging it out for weeks, or in our case, you know, adding another second assembly line to get a job we may not get a repeat of is not necessarily very good for the business. But we find right now, you know, our primary goal in that was to get those single unit turnkeys as inexpensive as possible. Now that we have that, right, and we were able to actually achieve that and we're doing that profitably on our side, now we're going to start looking at, you know, how we can continue to extrapolate those savings up the quantity chain.
Yeah.
Now, one of the key parts of your ability to offer a service, turnkey service like this, is the fact that you've got a large array of house parts, right? Mm-hmm. And if people are using those house parts, which are already loaded on your machines, I would presume, then the cost is going to come way down.
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah. So what we do two things with that from the cost perspective. One is that for our house parts, we offer those at a lower cost than you can typically get those in the volumes you're looking at. And then secondly, we give away the labor for free on those. because as, right. as you noted, we already yep. have the machines trained. I do yes. want to jump back to one of those keywords we used earlier. We were talking about the bingo. I'm going to use it now. it does also assist with just-in-time manufacturing and the predictability of manufacturing, in that we yep. always guarantee those parts will be available. And if we're going to end of yep. life any of those, we give you a personal 6-month notice on that.
Oh,
got it.
Nice.
Now, at the moment, you've only got passives, haven't you?
There's some passives.
Well, there's some diodes and things like right. that, but you don't have any chips.
It's pretty much jelly bean parts.
Yep.
Resistors, capacitors, that kind of stuff. Connectors. We're bringing in some more connectors. I think. Did you do the blog post yet, Ron?
No. We're going to do that. This is not an April Fool's joke. We're going to have a
someone hit the mute key. Mute.
Yeah. We're going to have a new set of house parts, a new addition to the house parts list coming out around Monday.
Cool.
Nice.
And
yeah. people can download these in some usable.
Yeah. So right form? Now we only have Eagle footprints of this stuff. Right. We're working on KiCad and DipTrace support.
But the data sheets are all there for the parts, so...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, so you just match the part number of what you guys have, the manufacturer part number, and it should just pull it right in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nice.
And in a lot of cases, if you're putting in resistors and capacitors, we'll automatically match based on the value and the footprint. We'll automatically match house parts and suggest those to you.
Excellent. Now, I noticed that you go down to 0402. You had too many issues with 0402 placement?
Not yet. Our machine's actually able to go down to 0201. We haven't tried that. It can do it.
There's a big difference between what it says it can do and what yield you get in practice.
So we have a universal GSM2, that's a mid-90s machine when it was designed. I think ours was produced in the mid-2000s. And it can do 042 pretty well.
Right.
That's at the threshold of its vision system that we have currently set up. We had to upgrade its cameras to do 0201.
Got it. And have you only got the single line, or have you got multiple lines?
Yeah, there's only one line.
Okay. Have you got any, at what point do you expand to a second line?
When it's filled.
And what sort of throughput business, and what kind of increase throughput
our current line can do about 6,000 parts an hour. So once we're at that, we'll probably start looking at getting either another machine to add on to the front end, like a chip shooter, or just add on to another line.
Yeah. And we can always add chips. So
what is the bottleneck? Is the bottle, because I assume that the bottleneck is like just the manual handling and dicking around and things like that. It's not actually the speed of the machine. I would be, especially if you're doing lots of, like if you've got 10 different jobs to do today, mm-hmm. I don't think the speed of the machine would come into it, right?
It's going to depend on which processes those jobs have. Because the pick and place, say, if we're doing a lot of chip parts, I mean, by like leaded chip parts, that can slow down quite a bit while it's validating those. But if it's a whole bunch of resistors and passives, it moves pretty fast. But it's going to depend on the mix of the job. Sometimes just going through the reflow of it is the slowest part of the process.
Yeah.
It takes about 6-7 minutes minimum.
It's painful, isn't it? Yeah.
I'll say the worst is actually because we have a selective solder to do our through-hole parts. And actually trimming the leads for all the parts before it goes in, that's what takes the longest.
Because
we build a pinball board for a company, and cutting all of the MOSFET leads and transistor leads are that takes like 10 minutes. And the surface mount goes through in about 4.5 minutes.
Yeah. Can you guys get like a bandsaw for that or what?
Mainly clip them.
Yeah.
Somebody sits there and clips them later.
Yeah, how many people have you got working there maintaining the line, if that's not corporate?
So we have 4 full-time employees right now, and our line workers tend to be based on capacity.
Oh, okay. Right. So they're just sort of casual. They come in and out.
Right. When we need them, we call them in. But usually we can handle a pretty decent amount of volume with actually just 2 people working the line at any given time.
Wow.
Nice. Yep.
So for the setup stuff, because I'm still a little confused about this. Okay, so first question I think is how many inline feeders do you have?
So the machine can do 64 feeders.
PTF.
Yeah, plus the PTF. So it's 32 per side, and the PTF is the platform tray feeder, which has 28 slots in it. So you can put 56 tray parts in there. And that basically has an elevator that indexes the parts, and it pulls the tray out, picks the part out, puts it on the conveyor, and runs the conveyor into the pick and place, and the pick and place picks it off the conveyor and then puts it on the board.
Oh cool. That's yep.
Yeah,
that's
so you impressive. Can we can run a lot of IC parts if they're on tray.
And we can actually mix trays too. So on one tray we can have 30 different parts on that tray.
Yeah.
Huh.
So would you prefer people order chips on trays, or would you prefer they order, like, you know, a standard SO8 or SO14? Would you prefer they're on reels or on trays?
We would prefer they let us order them for them.
Right. Yeah.
Yes. So depending on the size of the part, if it's small, yeah. if it's under 12 millimeter tape, we prefer it on on tape. If it's over that, then the PTF seems to win out in terms of speed and optimizing on space, because the wider feeders will take up more space on the machine.
Okay. So the other question I have about that then is, right now that you have the single board type thing, does that mean that you run mixed panels like Oshpark does, where there's multiple boards per panel?
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Isn't it possible though that, like, I'm imagining, you know, like a 18 by 24, you know, not like a huge panel. I don't know how big the panels you guys are using is, but like if you had, you know, maybe 30 different designs and all the designs are radically different, which probably isn't the case, but if they were all radically different, is it possible that you have to run multiple times through with the feeders, or how does that all work?
Yeah. So if we're talking about a 30 different one-off designs on there, the only parts that are going to be on feeders are going to be the house parts or common parts that we're likely to have in stock. And in those one-off designs, we're actually likely to place many of the unique parts on those by hand.
Aha, uh-huh. Right. Okay.
Because it's faster than trying to load up reels. And the wastage is, once you account for the wastage and trying to reel up those parts and then the additional labor, it actually gets more expensive to try to machine place those than to do them by hand.
Okay. Yeah.
How difficult does warehousing and sorting and of parts actually become, you know? Because I've been to these pick and place houses and they have just walls and walls of, and they have their own system for, you know, stock and all that sort of jazz.
That is the hardest thing.
Oh, really?
That is the hardest thing about my job.
Yep.
I probably spend half my time cursing at our inventory system.
And he's looking at me because I wrote that inventory system. So.
Do you guys have like vision for it, or how does it work? Is it just kind of indexing?
It's indexing and barcode based at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's fully, and again, it's integrated. So when someone places an order in, you know, we quote the parts for them and everything, and we actually see all the jobs coming through, and we see what needs to be ordered, what's in the inventory. You know, what distributor to order it from. So it's a fairly automated process on our end, but it does require a lot of data entry to keep it up to date.
How do you physically store all the parts? Do you have like pigeonholes on the wall, or do you have one of those fancy-pantsy automated machines that sort of you punch in the number and it rotates its carousel and it spits out the correct?
You know that thing earlier I said where we buy old machines and refurbish them?
That's right.
Yeah, we don't have anything fancy pants.
So boxes?
Right. Yeah, right now we use protective bins, and we're actually building out about 150, 200 square foot humidity controlled room right now.
Oh, wow. Nice. Okay. What parts have to go into the humidity controlled room?
Pretty much We're going to put everything in there because we'll have the space.
Right, okay.
Because if you have a house part reel that's on paper that just lies around for a while, and 60% humidity, that paper is going to stick to its that tape eventually.
Oh, Houston, and then, right.
Yeah, and so right, that tape right. is just Devil's never going to peel off, right? And you're going to have jams in your feeders. So keeping just even chip parts dry is pretty important for longevity of the material that holds the parts together.
But LEDs God, yep. do in particular LEDs hate are a the problem. Humidity.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, they do. Because when they heat up, if people don't know this, when the parts heat up, they can get moisture inside them. And then when they go through the reflow oven, that moisture inside can expand and then crack, you know, the lead can just, you know, oops.
Yeah, that's the problem with when people ship us parts and we just get like cut tape of like
right. some
like a FTDI chip that's highly susceptible to moisture. And you're like, I have no idea how long these have been on someone's shelf.
Yeah, right.
1977 date code. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, traditionally we'd have to, anything that's out of spec on the humidity, we have to pre-bake it before we can right. start placing it on the line. And that's just a nightmare. We want to minimize that as much as possible. So.
Yep. That's annoying. Have you ever been bitten by fake parts? Have you ever been duped?
Not yet. We try to buy everything through authorized distributors. And we pretty much right. hammer that home when people say, well, I can get this part cheaper on AliExpress. And I'm like, good luck.
Yeah, good luck. That, yeah, yeah, exactly.
You can hand out
that 4-week
lead
time from China, you know. Yeah. Yep. No. So I can imagine with your specialty being fast turnaround, you'd be a big user of Mouser, DigiKey, and all the other... You know, turnkey stockers.
Yeah, we are.
Is that where you get the majority of your parts from?
Yeah,
it seems to make sense, you know, and then you build that into your cost.
Yeah, the majority actually goes through Mouser since they're here in Texas, and we actually get ground shipping next day from them.
Oh,
nice.
Sweet.
Because people think that, you know, Mouser and DigiKey and the like are like super expensive, but they're not. You go and buy a reel of parts. It's not going to be much cheaper from an official distributor than it is from Mouser.
Yeah, unless you get like special pricing. If you get pricing direct from like TI,
unless you've got a business
account or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. But generally speaking, it's, you know, for your average punter who can get hold of these parts from your regular distributors, they're not that much more expensive. Is that what you guys have found?
Yeah, it's in fact one of the things that really eats you up when you're dealing with all these different distributors trying to find the cheapest possible prices for the parts are the shipping. A lot of people don't take that into account.
No,
they're like,
yeah, no.
Oh, I can get two of those parts for 30 cents each from this other distributor, so you should sell them to me at 30 cents each. And I'm like, but yeah, but it's $8 in shipping.
Dirt cheap. Some people insist on you using Koori and charging you $50.
Right.
You know? Well, over here in Australia you do because you've got to get them shipped, you know, internationally. I guess it's a bit better over there, but yeah.
Well, you guys have shipping, to put that stuff on a shelf, though, too. That's the other thing that people probably don't realize. It's just like the handling costs of anything. Like anytime you click add a part to your BOM on MacroFab, I'm sure that there's some overhead there just from processing, right?
Yeah, inventory, handling, making sure it goes in the right bin, et cetera.
Well, yeah, and at the end of the day, like any other – you know, good EMS, we have to provide lot control. So that means every part that comes in here, we order one resistor for you, right? We have to record what lot that resistor came out of, and a human has to sit there and record that information.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's not integrated. There's no digital integration for that kind of stuff.
We're working on that. It's sort of you have to do it from scratch with every distributor, and it takes a while.
Wow.
Trying to get them moving to integrate with you, who they think is a fairly small player, is a lot of times like you know, kind of watching molasses come out of the tree.
Yeah.
They'll get to you next week, then they'll tell you a time when they're going to get to you again to tell you when they might actually get to you.
That's it.
You whippersnappers and your bits and your programs and your Python and So actually, I've worked with manufacturers that don't do lot control at all. So that's a nice value add for people that are using your service. So that's good.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, at the end of the day, we're going to charge you to manage your BOM for you, so we should at least provide a good service, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so do you guys find that you're doing a lot of the, so, I mean, you have the in-house parts. Do you guys ever make the decision, like, so say I go order an op amp, will you just order like a cut tape of like a 10 cut tape of that just for my project? Or will you see guys sometimes then go and say, we're going to order that whole reel and then keep it in-house? Like, how do you make that decision? And if you do, how do you make it?
It really depends on the part. Mm-hmm. And how many you're ordering, and how the price breaks of that part work out.
Oh, okay. So you do like a break-even analysis and then say, if it's above this, then we might as well just have it as a reel.
Exactly. Right. And there's also, like, if you're ordering just one board, and if it's not a rush job, we'll usually not even order overage on a chip part, like an IC.
Yeah.
We'll just get one.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a pain in the butt to inventory, but it works out. If it's a rush job, we pretty much always get overage.
Would you even bother? Because you're just getting the one part and you know that person's only ordered one. Would you even bother at that point? Wouldn't you just get the part and whack it straight on the board? And
well, it's in some cases, you know, we see not just the one order. We see all the orders that are coming through the system. And we also see the projects that aren't orders yet.
Ah, right. So you can see when people are trialing on the website and uploading their things as a trial and...
And we can estimate demand from that. So it's not unusual for us to look at this and go, you know, hey, this part over here, 15% of the projects that have been uploaded are using a part that this would serve, function for. So why don't we carry it in-house?
Yeah, it's like the part we're adding soon is the BAT 148 diode.
And it's that's BAT-42, right?
Or it's BAT-42.
BAT-42.
Yeah,
the Jelly the Bean diode insert part number. So yeah, we're adding that to it because we see that a lot in our projects that are being uploaded.
I mean, we've seen it as much as like 20% of all projects, not necessarily the BAT-42, but that or one of those class have been in there. So
yeah.
That'd be rather frustrating because you see people, you know, using all these subtly different parts, and you know they could consolidate. You know, they know that, why didn't use a BC547? They chose a, some other one, which is, it's just doing some jelly bean switching operation. They could have used a 547, but they go and use some other weird-ass number.
Right.
Just got to charge $50 for that one, right? I mean, you just got to you do it economically.
Yeah, it has a placement charge at that point.
and that's one thing we actually do, especially with the resistors, is we try to match within ranges. People will put exact values for the resistors because they're there with the calculator and
When
you're doing the schematic design, you're like, yeah, that needs to be a 6.317 ohm. Click, that's what I'm using. And
and you can only get it on 20-week lead time.
So we'll look at that and automatically, if someone doesn't put in a specific part number, I must have this part. We'll start suggesting things within a certain range of the values they provide so that they can kind of see, hey, maybe this will work for all of those components you have there.
All right. Is that sort of like a semi-automated online, not automated, but like you don't have to actually send, do you have to like send an email and go, hello, Mr. Jones, we found that you use this part, blah, blah, blah. Or is that all part of the online
It does it automatically.
Tool which you've got.
When you upload your files, as it's processing the bill of materials, it does it automatically.
Ah, excellent. Ooh, I'm going to have to try this. This looks really jazzy.
We've actually been finding a lot of users will, once they realize there is a house part list, they'll actually change the design and to use these parts. It also helps that we do have footprints for Eagle. Definitely need to get the other EDA tools.
Yeah, that's good, though.
The holy grail of everything, like having so many in-house parts that, people would rarely have to do something different,
That's going to be the end goal for the house part list is have so many well-used parts that we don't have to really worry about, weird parts.
Yeah.
Right. And then, there are just the parts that are truly unique and custom and aren't used in every single project out there.
Which seems to be every one of my designs because I'm always doing something niche. I'm using some weird-ass part that nobody else has ever used.
Yeah, but you don't use all of that. You use
no.
As well,
it's
right?
You know, like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, 90% of it might be, you know, Joe Blog stuff, but yeah, then there's like, you know, 10% of these weird ass parts that I can only get from only one person in the world's got stock of, you know.
Yeah, actually, we've had a few designs like that recently. And one guy, it's a one-time programmable chip, so they had to be sent to us pre-programmed, and we couldn't just order them for them.
Yeah. Right.
It's got that crazy part number that nobody understands because it's got the OTP number right. That's assigned or whatever, right?
Do you order your microcontrollers pre-programmed? Because Mouser and DigiKey offer, and the manufacturers and distributors offer that service to pre-program the micros, or do you do it yourself?
We're doing it ourselves, but we are looking to switch to that where appropriate. Because one of the things we're going to be doing, the feature isn't fully enabled in the UI yet with the firmware. You're actually going to be able to specify multiple different pieces of firmware and software to upload if it's part of a multi-step process. And then we're going to leverage that same capability from the front end to capture the testing process.
So this will be especially useful if people haven't put an in-circuit serial programming header on their board, right? If they're using like a little, you know, a SO8 or even one of those little SOT23 micros and they haven't, you know, they're using all the pins, they haven't built in a programming port, well, how do you program the part?
Right.
You know, well, you may as well just order it pre-programmed from the distributor. Send them your firmware file and be done with it.
The only challenge we've run into with that is getting them to negotiate on volume pricing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, so for low volume stuff, it makes way more sense for us to do the programming in-house.
Right.
It's when, you know, they need 2,000 of these things programmed.
Even for those fiddly parts, what if somebody sends you a little 5-pin SOT23 micro? That's real fiddly to put in a zero insertion force test thing.
It may, in that case, make sense to order it from the manufacturer, from the distributor pre-programmed.
Yeah, but they're doing the same thing, right? You got the fiddly fixture or they do.
Right. I know. Somebody's got it.
It depends on how bored Parker is and whether or not he wants to build a fixture for that today.
Yeah. That's great. I'm surprised you do this with so few people, actually. But I'm guessing you guys are young, single, and you don't have lives. Right?
Well, a couple of us are, but...
right.
No, I mean, at the end of the day, it's really about effective time management. We have more people, full-time people in engineering than anything else here. You know, we look at myself, we have another full-time developer in addition to me. Parker's primarily in engineering. And then we have one full-time ops guy, and then we backfill that with labor as we need, because effectively the lines, until you get to a certain capacity and you're having to manage a lot of the people and the tasks that have to be done, they're pretty efficient at this point. And with the stuff we've built, there's not a lot of question of what we have to do on any given day or how to do it. It's just a matter of, do we have enough hours on it today? So
do you have any, how many projects would you get in that are just people that are just so clueless at either board layout or design for manufacturing? And
I was going to actually ask, how crappy can my bomb be? So if we could throw that one in there as well.
Yeah.
If I could be the example crappy uploader.
Or more to the point, what percentage of projects would come in that are just so easy for you to process and do and that are all right, and the people obviously knew what they were doing compared to the ones who don't?
So we're at this stage, we're young enough, we're nimble enough that we like to say we're dedicated to every customer's success. So we'll do unnatural things.
Oh, tick. Hang on. I'll just cross that off my bingo sheet.
Right, check. But no, we'll literally do unnatural things, like sit there for 2 hours on the phone with the customer, helping them correct their BOM, doing it for them in the UI. If they run into issues uploading, we go and just do it ourselves for them and get it
startups
all prepared.
All right.
But they're actually a huge chunk. I want to say at least 70% of the projects we see are at least the customer can themselves get it to what we would call a functioning product within an hour on the site.
Wow.
Oh, nice.
That's very impressive.
Awesome.
Yeah, our currently, the Chris was talking about the bomb. We currently have a specific format that has to be so we have all the information we need to display all the information and have all the lines set up mm-hmm. for that job. We are going to have an importer eventually, but
yeah. Well, I mean, to be clear, for certain CAD tools, we can extract that automatically.
Yeah.
Eagle, DipTrace, KiCad, we can do that automatically from the source files. But for other EDA tools, we don't just take any old garbage throw at us, if you will, right? It has to be a specific format. And if they can make it past that hurdle, they're usually good at that point.
Right. Yeah, well, that was going to be my next question. You know, what if I don't use Eagle? You know, can I just upload my Gerbers and a text bill of materials? Or
yeah, so you can upload your Gerber files, and we call it the XYRS file, which is the merge bill of materials and placement data. So
we need both of that
to actually manufacture it, because obviously we can't automate the assembly if we don't know where the parts go. Yep.
So there's like a format that people can just go and match against, like in Excel or CSV or whatever. Mm-hmm. Just this column here, this column there, mm-hmm. that kind of idea.
Absolutely.
Huh. That is very cool. Yeah, and especially
I gotta try it, Chris.
I have tried it with the BenchBuddy, and actually I did want to ask about that. Mm-hmm. Can you guys? So does it not show the fourth layer? It's a four-layer board. Does it not do four-layer right now?
We don't do four layers through the UI yet. Okay. That's coming very soon, though. We can, though. We are doing four layers for a number of customers. All we ask right now is you just tell us that you need to do it, and we'll adjust your quote before you buy it.
Just because PCBs are pricier kind of thing?
Yeah. It's substantially more expensive than the very small volumes.
Yeah, the four layer is going to come pretty soon. I mean, I think we're
within weeks of that.
Yeah,
rolling out.
Cool. Yeah.
Who's making your bare boards at the moment? Are they local?
So it depends. Oh, it depends on the volume. For one offs and fast stuff, it's actually Oshpark does our boards.
Oh, nice. Right.
For the higher volume and the big panels, we go over to we have a shop over in Korea that we have a broker with, and they do a pretty good job on the boards. The quality is pretty good,
the price is good, and they're consistent on their delivery. So
yeah,
we've had a lot of bad experiences, and we are happy to shop around as we're doing that. A lot of times, you know, depending on the number of one-offs we get in a day, they'll all go to Oshpark because they're just not a panel full worth of one-offs. And some days, you know, we cross past our panel threshold and they go to Korea. So,
and so when they do go to Oshpark, so that's just all hand placement because it's not actually going through the machine, or do you have like brackets that hold it when it goes to the pick
and
place?
We have a jig that will hold it when it goes through the machine. That's indexed so that we can. So the machine knows where the board's at. But there's also a lot of hand placements too on some of that.
Yeah, and again, when we're looking at a one-off, it may sometimes just make sense just to do it all by hand.
Yeah. And I know this is probably a sensitive question, but are the prices real? Like, to be honest, like I could very easily see that low quantity stuff, like if you were interested in that, you could make that a loss leader, right? Because then you're trying to get people in and trying to do that thing. I mean, so I don't know if you guys want to talk about that, but is it real? Yes or no is fine.
So as long as we don't make a mistake on any job, those prices you see there are profitable for us.
Perfect.
We don't.
And that's what I'd expect.
Right. And I'll be honest with you, right? We're not going to grow into be a huge company on one-off prototypes.
Right.
No, exactly. But I see that I'm typing the quantity in here, like for that example board, like it's $52 to get one board manufactured, assembled. Does that include shipping?
No, shipping is determined. No, right. You get to that point once you put in your shipping address.
Okay, it's $52 for one board. Then if I type in 10 boards, it drops down to $45, and then I go up to 100 boards, and it drops down to $34.80. So it's not... You know, it's not like a massive sort of, you know, a drastic drop. And if I go up to 1,000, it's $22.70. People might think, if it's $50 for one board, or $58 or whatever it was, then, well, it must be $5 for 1,000 boards. But it's not, right?
No,
yeah.
It's not quite to that level. And what is the bottleneck in the pricing there? Is it the labor? Is it the parts? Is it the
it's mostly
bare board? What?
It's two things. It's the PCB and the parts themselves.
So the bare PCB, so the raw material costs.
Right. Yeah, you can't get lower than raw material costs. So
right. Of course. Right.
And obviously we are a for-profit business, so we can't give away the labor we have to do. We can't just say we're going to charge you exactly what we pay for the PCBs and lose money on the shipping and everything else. So.
Well, right. I noticed that for the one-off board that costs the customer $50 to $50. I mean, $12.22 of that is labor. Mm-hmm. I assume are you only factoring generic running of the assembly machine kind of labor?
No. In a one-off, actually, what we do is we look at the actual parts you have on the board and the kinds of parts they are, the how they are mounted on the board, and we charge for a one-off the worst case scenario, effectively, if we have to hand place each part. That's what we charge on one-off. Ah,
that makes sense.
But it's 12 bucks. That's the thing that I guess Chris and I are shocked at. It's 12 bucks for labor. That doesn't even pay for 1 hour of a low, a low-end worker.
Right. It shouldn't take them 1 hour to put that board together. If so, they're way too slow.
Okay, but the one-off board, there's all the stuff in the background. You guys have to do work there.
Yeah, but there's
a lot
of placement. Right? Dave, you're looking at a board that uses in-house parts, though, too, right?
Right.
I mean, this has parts on it.
So
you'd have to upload a different one.
That, all those resistors and capacitors are already on that machine, so it just grinds on through that pick and place and gets populated, and then I think it's like the SD card and a couple of the
chips.
Yeah, and some of the chips just get hand placed. So it's like, you're talking six parts that just have to be placed manually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that takes
Which is fairly quick.
Yeah, it's about 10 seconds per
minutes.
Part.
Right. And if you go to the BOM viewer there and you kind of scroll down to one of those chip parts, you'll see we're actually charging you for, to hand place one of those microchips. About, I think, like the pick, we're charging $3.
I see it.
Just to place that.
It's the prop.
Yep.
The prop, sorry.
Oh, I see it. Yeah, it's individually. There's one part here. It's to mount the 6 megahertz crystal is going to cost me 52 cents in labor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's incredible.
And then when you adjust the volume, that labor charge scales.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, got it. Got it.
Very
so
cool.
That's the one. So the propeller chip, the 44-pin quad flat pack, that's $3.30 to actually place that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, the visibility in.
Yeah,
this
is what
is
I always
incredible.
Wanted because, yeah, because when you're optimizing for a manufacturing process too, you want like engineers want to know this. We want to know what knobs can I turn, and if I go replace a part with a different footprint, maybe it takes up more space and it costs a little bit more on the PCB, but now I trade off that little bit more PCB space and I save a bunch on the placement stuff. So that's really awesome.
It's amazing.
And we're even working on making that easier, because right now you have to find the part in the bill of materials, adjust your volume and all of that. We're actually adding a feature soon that'll allow you at the searching phase, where you're going to be searching for a part to put in your bill of materials there, it's going to give you a full comparison on all of those axes of the price difference at different volumes. So you can see, for example, a house part may be cheaper at a very low volume, but a particular market part, once you get to 1,000 units, that one actually saves you 3 cents a board. Right? And be able
very
to
nice.
See and visualize that out so you can make more informed decisions about what you're purchasing.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really awesome.
I love it.
I want
to try
to
It's just so jazzy. The visibility
Dave, you
is
should
just
try,
like.
Yeah,
I'll get my I'll get Dave too, who's my other
mini
who's
Dave.
My
mini Dave.
He's my mini Dave. I might get him to put my microcurrent through this as a test and see what spits out the other end, maybe.
And one thing when you're in there, we get a lot of questions about things a lot of time. We really wanted to have this be a good user experience. So there's not a lot of labels for everything, but almost everything in that screen is clickable, or you can mouse your mouse over it and it gives you
more
information.
That, Yeah, that's nice.
Just sweet. Start clicking on stuff, and you'll see the whole thing will start to change and rearrange based on what you clicked
on. Yeah, I can see it. Click to edit everything in the bill of materials. Wow.
That is very nice.
Very nice. I'm impressed.
I wanted to ask about the... how do you guys do solder paste as well? Do you have one of the solder paste printers, or do you guys actually stencil?
Yeah, so right now we do stencils. Low volume stuff, it's Captain. High volume, we go stainless with a frameless stencil. I really, really, really want a jetter.
Yeah, he's working on me every cheap, day though. About that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm on eBay.
They're not
like,
cheap. I play with one that's like 20 grand.
Oh, yeah, that's it. That's actually a pretty good price.
Yeah, it's not going to work for 10 grand.
Oh, it totally will. Yeah.
Eventually.
But they're
yeah.
not that quick. They're pretty slow.
Yeah, they're
generally more for rework than they are for, well, the ones I've used are generally more
for
rework purposes.
Dude, I've seen some fast ones.
Yeah,
I saw one in Michigan that was insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got to see some before, and even ones that are moderately speed, like if they can do about like 2,000 dots an hour. I mean, that would actually work pretty well for us at the current moment.
All right.
And we could bump the price a little bit down since we don't have to get stencils at that point.
And I keep telling him, you know, we could give away the stencils for free for like 2 years for the price of one of those.
Right. Long-term investment, Chris. Just Parker, keep working on it.
Yeah, I'm working on it.
Just keep you can do it, man. Just the whatever the cost-benefit analysis. Just keep doing those and slipping them under his door, or mail them to his house.
At some point, they'll tell me that's the primary bottleneck in the line, and then that's when we'll get one.
Yeah, that's actually that's what actually takes the long on the stainless stencils is swapping the stencils out because we have a semi-automatic machine, which means we have to load the board manually, and then you press print, and it goes and wipes the board, and then opens it back up. Setting that up correctly that takes longer. Set that up correctly sometimes than the actual pick and place machine. So having a stencil printer would actually make that much faster. Problem is, we have to give it more data from the users to make that process work.
Right.
Oh, you mean if they were not using because I mean, right now, if they pull in the design files, that's not a big deal because you can just extract that stuff, right?
Yeah.
But
actually, we get most of the data we can get from Eagle KiCad and DipTrace. We can get the paste, so if you look at like a paste file, it'll show the apertures of where the paste needs to go. Well, you need to know the centers of those for a dispenser unit. So that's a completely different file format.
Yeah.
We can get most of that data, but it's just more data that's required.
I thought the machines would come with software that would import the paste Gerber and then
hear them
or
laughing,
the paste
Dave.
File and then
so Dave thinks it's magical fairies
so
that do
actually
this
they
stuff,
do they do they don't work too well.
I was going to say, it's not that I can imagine it's not that hard to do some processing on the paste file and then determine the center point of each pad. I wouldn't have thought that would be rocket science.
You would think.
And it would have been key to enabling a product like one of these stencil printers.
Yeah, so you get that feature when you spend a lot of money on the machine.
you get a reliable feature.
Yeah, reliable feature.
They all have that feature.
Yeah,
it doesn't work most of the time. We actually did have a small pick and place that had a paste jet feature or paste dispensing feature, and it claimed to have that capability, and it never once worked.
No,
we had to generate our own paste files for it.
Yeah,
and then the machine would just gum up all the time and put down dots that were the size of my pinky on a 0.2 millimeter pad, and
yeah.
Just heat it up really slowly.
Oh goodness!
Is there a lot of data that you guys need for the reflow profile then as well? Because I know that can be kind of dicey. So when we had the guys on from Salier, they were talking about the necessity of good profiles and stuff like that. Do you have to store that per part, or is it just kind of general?
So. About 90% of the boards that we run, we really don't have to worry about it. We do check if someone's got weird parts. We do check the data sheet, make sure, hey, you know, this can't get over a certain temperature. And so we just, you know, and we just knock the temperature down in the oven or have to raise it up. If it's like a BGA package, we've got a couple different profiles that we already know that are pretty standard with our reflow oven. So we actually don't have to reprofile it. We just go, okay, we know that these settings give us this profile. We punch that in and go.
Okay. And when we're looking at oven profiles, we're really looking at like rate of error. You know, I mean, if we're talking about an extremely sensitive part, right, we want to know that we're not bringing that over temperature. But for most parts, you know, a perfect profile is talking about like the difference between, you know, a 0.3 and a 0.5% error rate in the process. When we're doing a one-off, you know, we visually inspect those. It's less expensive to verify that and fix any problems with it than it is to come up with a custom profile to avoid tombstoning for this one part.
Yeah, go ahead. Did you say that you read a lot, that you have to read data sheets for all these too then?
Only on weird parts that I don't recognize.
Not the foreseen kind
of
stuff.
Yeah, so if someone's got an S&D connector, I'm totally going to read that data sheet and make sure it says, you can't get this part over X degrees or it'll melt.
The plastic melts.
Chocolate connectors, huh?
They actually turn some, I can't remember what plastic it is. It turns and looks like marshmallows.
Yeah, fluffs up.
It flips up and turns brown. Just like marshmallows.
Like the JST, the white ones that those.
I've seen those.
Molex connectors do that.
And so kind of, you know, built into that process, what we've done is obviously with every job, we have to kit it. And in that process, we've got in our software, the person who's kitting it has to look at all the parts he's got. And he actually marks parts that bring some concern in the process for him. And then the person at that stage in the process can see those notes and say, okay, well, I need to check the temperature for this part, or I need to switch to profile 2 for this particular job.
Yeah, that's good that you guys have those kind of things in place. I mean, do your people that are doing kitting have to have a lot of expertise?
Generally, expertise, no. They have to be very paranoid.
always ask questions is what we tell them.
Right.
Yeah.
Never assume. Never assume. Assumption is probably the mother of all screw-ups, right?
If you don't know, if you have any question, just raise your hand and say, hey, look, can you look at this for me? That solves all kinds of problems down the line.
Yep.
I'm curious too about the style of projects coming in, because I'm always curious, like, especially for like low quantity stuff, and like Dave mentioned earlier in the show about, you know, people getting into the Kickstarter world and stuff like that, that you'd see a lot of Arduino, you know, not clones, but, you know, derivatives, stuff like that. A lot of Atmega 328 type projects. Are you guys seeing a lot of spread? I mean, I'm always interested about analog stuff like that. Are you seeing spread into a wide variety of products so far, and like different parts being placed, or is it kind of centralized around common themes in the maker movement?
Right now at this stage, you know, given that not everybody knows about us yet, what we're finding is we're attracting people who are doing either very complex things. We got a job we're looking at right now. It's like 700 parts on a 7-inch square board, to doing lots of, or you know, a lot of times they want their BGA. Got to get my BGA placed. I can't do this by hand. So this is a great thing to outsource for. But we also see a lot of like adapters and connectors. We have a lot of small companies using us. And I am just shocked at how many little adapters and connectors we're producing right now.
Because that used to be really hard when I was a boy, right? Before you could buy cheap prototype PCBs made, right? It'd cost you, you know, $800 to get a one-off board made, right? This is what it used to cost 10, 15 years ago, right?
It still costs for some people.
$40 connector. Just so difficult. So you would just, you know, you'd etch the board yourself, or you'd jury rig it somehow. But now, you know, bam, you can just get a board from Oshpark and there's your, you know, and solder the damn thing together. And you've got a little adapter, a custom little adapter for $10 or something. It's crazy.
And there's a lot of industrial companies actually using us. And, you know, that's a big thing for them, because a lot of stuff they're doing, they're not going to make 100, even 100 of.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a couple.
Yeah. Right?
And they need it. They need it. And that's all they know. And they need three of them for a customer this month. So
when you guys are basically replacing an in, not replacing, but you're supplementing like an in-house tech, that's what I, at companies I've been at. Right. Like,
pretty much, yeah.
There's a guy that was sitting there just building our boards all day because we had to, we had to have him, and he's doing protos for us, and now I can send him to you.
So, yeah, we would often throw this over the wall to the guy in the lab, right? We would have a resident lab manager who'd take care of the parts and stocking the thing. We'd have a resident lab tech who would, you know, you could just throw this over the wall, build me one of these. And
so these guys are killing jobs, Dave. Did you hear? I heard that.
Right.
I don't know what you.
Well,
I think some of these guys are just telling their bosses, "Yeah, I'm just getting so much better at doing this."
Yeah, right. You guys should have Shell Corporation so that it's like, you know, like it's a different name on the credit card statement. So it's like, you know, something something training or something like that, you know, and then
Parker's,
the board show up.
Parker's been known to, you know, take cash out on the the driveway out there.
Oops, buddy. Yeah, you want a board assembled?
Want to buy a board?
Got that for you, man.
I got some breakout boards at a great price.
So I'm curious about, I mean, like, especially with this adapter board thing as well. I mean, like, so pulling in design files for connectors and stuff like that, is that a big a lot of manual side for you guys for like you know, new connectors and stuff like that? Is that normally going to be hand placed and everything like that?
Yeah, for a lot of these projects, for the volume we're looking at, where, you know, we get like two or three in an order. And, you know, it's something you can snap in half a second. We would do those by hand.
Gotcha.
And we do the majority of those by hand because it's just, again, it's so much easier and faster to do it that way.
Yeah, and it's only a couple. It's just easier to say, hey, put this part there and done. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Are you seeing mostly, this ties into Chris's question about the Kickstarter and all that sort of, you know, the type of boards, are they mostly like just designed to be like bare board products, or are they, or can you tell that they're, oh, they've carefully designed this board, it's going to go into a custom housing, blah 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 blah?
The vast majority we see are bare boards.
I would have thought so, yeah.
But we are trying to encourage the customers to make them look better, add enclosures, you know. You can make a little more money if it looked like a more professional product, you know. And
I was going to say, is there another branch off there for we'll do your custom enclosure for you? You'll get into the 3D CAD side of things. We'll take your 3D CAD file and...
I will say we want to help our customers solve the enclosure problem this year.
Oh, nice. Ooh, okay. That's soon. Wow.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. Go to buy one of those, you know, $100,000 3D printers. And, yep.
No, nobody buys those anymore, though. They just lease them now. So.
Just or buy 300, you know, $1,000 printers instead. That's what I
want. You'll see that $200 one that's on Kickstarter, $179 Delta bot.
No. Really?
It won't happen. Yeah. It won't happen. They cannot make a profit
on the
air. They will fold.
Their Kickstarter goal in one day.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Of course they did, but they'll fold. Yeah. They won't be able to produce it, I guarantee.
Well, even if they can, I mean, anyway, can they support all the service calls, you know, all the support?
Yeah.
You know?
No, they won't be able. Somebody did an article on this. It's impossible to make a 3D printer under $300. You can't do it.
Yeah.
I think I saw
it's
that
just,
one.
It's just too involved. It's just there's too mechanical... Too many mechanical bits to it. There's a limit. You know, it's not like boards and components. You know, you can churn out, you know, PCBs ever cheaper, you know, by using Jelly Bean grey market parts and then getting your labor in China, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, complex machines take money to build, unfortunately.
Yeah, and people often forget the warranty, the returns on those. You know, you're going to replace, you know, especially on a 3D printer, you may replace, I wouldn't be surprised if someone was replacing one out of every 20 or one out of every 30.
Yeah, with a complicated machine like that.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, totally. Alignments and or tolerances and all that crap, right?
Even like complicated things like car transmissions, I was looking at 2% is a good number for failure on a transmission.
Really?
I'm like, that seems a little high to me.
It does.
Especially if you're driving in the car on the highway at the time.
Yeah.
Now, what about the test side of things? Mm-hmm. Designed for test. Do you build custom test jigs for people, or do you just want to stick to the assembly?
You know, we can actually, for all of our, we have a handful of customers we actually do end-to-end Kickstarter services for, where we not only source everything, we manufacture it, we program it, we test it, assemble, and fulfill it for them. So in that process, we got to make sure that that's a pristine product going out the door. Otherwise, they look bad, and then we, by extension, look bad and don't get any further business. so generally, we will either the customer will actually design the test jig for us, or they'll pay us to design a custom jig for them.
And we do help them if they're still in the design phase to make sure, hey, we can test this, and it won't cost an arm and a leg.
Mm.
If you add these pins on here and this, if you add a test port on there, that'll like, you know.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. Or design the panel for testing so we can test, you know, all 18 at once and stuff like that.
Once. Right. Yep. Awesome.
It's.
You mentioned the fulfillment. Mm-hmm. How much of a pain in the ass is fulfillment? How do you go about doing that? Do you do it yourself, or do you like just sit in a room,
label printer?
We've got to do it all night, unpacking and shipping with the label printer.
I actually do all the shipping. My night job.
and I write all the software.
Congratulations.
That solves all the problems he runs into while he's doing that. So.
Yes, it's actually not too bad right now. We got a lot of good software that makes that a lot easier.
Wait, is this what you meant, Parker, when you said you moved closer? Does that just mean you're sleeping in the shipping department?
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
Startups, at our old shop, we were actually one warehouse down. I had a cot in there.
Yeah. Startups.
We also mentioned that there's a brewery right next door. They were literally next door then. So that's part of the reason
Living the dream.
Yeah.
Why are all their labels on upside down? I don't know.
Wake me up in an hour.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So that's really a thing. It's actually, there's not a lot of work to do in it until something goes wrong. When something goes wrong, that's when all the work really, you know, kicks in on that, dealing with the postal service, dealing with the customers, and by this I mean the end customer, the people getting the product. You know, nobody doesn't, you know, nobody's happy when they don't get the thing they're looking for. So just trying to, you know, keep everybody happy in that process. And so this, we tend to work with the customers as well, our customers, to, you know, ensure that they understand that there's going to be some problems, and we produce a little overage so we can make that easier on their customer. And just, you know, no questions asked, a package is lost, let's send out a new one, like, right away.
Yep. Always cheaper.
Easier. Yep.
Yeah.
Have you ever sat there and thought, geez, I think we're biting off more than we can chew, trying to do too many things, trying to do everything?
Oh, man.
Has that ever crossed your mind, or has that been your goal and that's what you're going to do regardless?
It's been a goal, but I think every startup feels like that sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
It's a good night when I don't go to bed worried.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah, yeah.
It usually means I had maybe one glass of wine too many or something. But
yeah.
But can you see that happening down the line, that you're going, well, you know, designing cases or testing and shipping is just not the thing we want to do?
You know, we do actually do get that question a lot, mostly from potential investors. Like, don't you think this is just too much?
Right.
Don't you think that there's not a way you can make more money off these people by doing less for them?
Which is all they care about, right? Making more money out of the people. They don't care about your philosophy and goal.
Right. So that,
like, oh, they might have a token. They might care a token amount, but, you know.
So that, to be honest, you know, it always seems like it's too much when we had a problem today, we're behind, or, you know, something's broken. Yeah. But I just, you know, if we weren't doing all this, I don't know that I'd want to do this. You know, I don't want to do just PCB assembly. That's kind of boring.
Right.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
Yeah.
It's I like to build people's products, not their boards.
Right.
Got it.
Yeah, I like that.
I can dig that. Yeah.
I have to circle back around to my question about me being sloppy. And so if I send you guys a bomb with like a really bad bomb, and I think you answered that you said like 70% of the people are in decent shape, but like my question there was actually more around like, so if I send you file that all of the resistors just say 1K 0805? Like, how do you...
Well, first of all, they spend 10 minutes just sitting around cacking themselves laughing. Oh, Chris Gamble, what a dickhead.
I mean, no, because I think... I mean,
look
like
what he did. Can you believe this? Oh.
Why, I mean, well, I don't see the problem. Like, I mean, like, honestly, I don't see the problem there. Like, if you're going to send it to a contract manufacturer, they're going to replace them all anyways, right? I mean, they're gonna go and take house parts just at any CM. So, I mean, can you guys handle that?
So if you just had a board full of 1Ks and you actually meant for those to be 1Ks, yeah, that's not a problem for us. We wouldn't be happy with you because we might lose some money on that deal.
Oh, of course, yeah, it's better to use your part
number.
Right.
Because if it's all the same resistor as a house part, you know, we may not actually make any money on that board. That's not a suggestion.
No. So what I'm actually asking about is like the detection algorithm that you guys have. So if it says 1K0805, does your algorithm then go and say, here's our house part, and then it'll just recommend that for all the parts?
Yes. Correct. And even worse, because it's trying to simplify your bomb view, or it's worse depending on if this was a mistake on your part or if this was intentional, it'll actually group those all up automatically into one bomb line as well.
Yeah, no, that's what I'd expect. Yeah. I mean, I even if it was like, not that they would all be listed separately, although KiCad cannot put it like that sometimes, which is weird, but I just meant like just the detection side of things, because, you know, like if I'm sending it off to a CM, I hate the passive stuff. I mean, like if it's just the jelly bean, I think that's, you know, that's nice to be able to just have it loosey-goosey 1K, 0805, 1%, you know, I don't care.
And that's like the thing I was talking about earlier. If you had a 1K and a 995 and a 1100, our system would automatically try to suggest the 1K for all of those lines to you.
Right.
Is there a way to pull that back out into the files as well? I mean...
To get your bomb back,
like back annotate almost.
Not yet, but that's coming.
Okay.
Yeah, there's going to be an export function soon-ish.
Because we generated actually a lot of files from your project. You know, everything from SVGs to our format data files, and some things your CAD might not normally produce, like a paste file or a combined placement and bill of materials. And we want to give you the ability to actually get those back out so you can use them for your purposes.
One of the things I like the best about this system, it allows the schematic as a design, as the control document. That's what I actually love about it. I love that about all these kind of systems where if I want to change something, it should be, you know, I go submit it to GitHub with that one change, that 1K becomes 2K, and then I don't generate a spreadsheet. I don't have that decoupled from the schematic. You know, like I want the schematic to be the be all end all truth of my world. And I think that you guys allow that.
And you and I think alike. I wish more customers thought that way.
Yeah. Well, I've screwed up enough spreadsheets and to disastrous effects that's the problem, right? I mean, and I think that's one reason I'm such a big fan of KiCad too, is that, you know, one of the reasons that I've always said that that's impeding schematics as a control document is, you know, if you have to pay $5,000 for each seat of the schematic tool or the entire layout tool, no one else can go in and change it, right? You know, it's only going to be that one person with the seat, and that sucks. Now, if it's open source or if it's really low cost, then anyone can go in and change it. You may not want them to, but that's possible. And you could have a production person go and change that file and, you know, revision control it and get approval and stuff like that. But you can actually change it at the schematic level. And that's really important for me.
And I 100% agree. I mean, we really, you know, just coming from a open source background, I mean, we really need to look at that original source code as sort of the word I'm looking for here, the exact representation of that, not all the artifacts you produce from that.
Right. Yep.
The canonical representation of it. There we go.
Is that on the bingo list?
We don't talk software enough to say canonical, so.
But, you know, I mean, that from a perspective, I come from a software background. So, you know, to me, it seems odd that there's something other than the source code which defines the, you know, how to actually build this product.
Right.
And that has always seemed weird for me in the hardware world. And I'm always working with our customers to try to say, let's do something other than an Excel file. but yeah. let's not use an Excel file to upload that information.
Yeah. Can you guys pull off GitHub or?
Can we? No, no. Not right now. We probably will later. We haven't okay. actually had a lot of demand for that because most of our customers actually are using private or proprietary designs.
Oh yeah, but there's right. private repos. I mean,
yeah, true.
You could, but it's. I think just a lot of hardware people aren't using GitHub or just revision control in general. I know that. I mean, Dave, you said Altium has revision control, right?
Yeah, it does. Has its own flavor. Yep.
Yeah. I wish more hardware people would use something like GitHub. Because right. once, because I never used revision control like that until I started working with Chris, and we use SVG,
SVN,
mm-hmm. or
SVN
subversion.
Yeah.
And that was. That was okay, and then we started using Git, and I really like it.
Yeah. I mean, just from... And especially if you're using, you know, text-based CAD files as well, so you can... Mm-hmm. I mean, you're never going to see a perfect diff, but, you know, if you can start to diff files and actually see some legit differences on, you know, especially BOMs or even just the source file, the schematic itself, seeing new entries and stuff like that, that can really help with that kind of thing.
And we've even seen, you know, from GitHub, I think they've done, especially for some of the 3D models, I think they have done visual diffs on the 3D models.
Yeah.
And I think if more people were using, you know, open source, you know, EDA tools with that, we'd probably see visual diffs from them on the schematics and the board designs as well.
Visual diff Gerbers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a guy that did a visual diff on with the Gerber generation script, and then he did an overlay, and then... Yeah,
I saw that actually. I used that for a prototype we built.
Oh, nice!
Earlier last year, we actually had a feature in the UI to do diffs, and it was really cool. But it was just way too much to deal with, so we took it out.
Makes sense.
On the software side of things, how much work has gone into producing all this magic? All this software magic. I was going to say it's probably the majority of your development, right?
Has to be. The UI actually, you know, we kind of take take sort of an API first approach. So we start with an API for any capability, and then we put the UI on top of that. It's just so much easier to work from that perspective. It allows us to we do what we call a microservice architecture in the back end, so we're able to split up the workload amongst many different servers. So the user interface part is not a whole lot of time. It's mm-hmm. all of those models and controllers and everything behind it that really take right. the most time.
And how many people you got working on all this?
Right now we have two people developing full time. We're actually adding two more here as soon as we can find the people.
Yeah, and Chris is actually one of those two people.
Right, yeah.
So we actually
this is
only
what
have
we
one
specialize
other guy.
Here on the Amp Hour, finding people.
Right, we can always put out the call at the end here.
We've had, three or four guests practice? At least who have found people through this show.
Yeah.
Hey, we're hiring and we pay industry standard salaries too for a startup.
Whoa, guys, really sell it on that one.
Yeah.
If you look at a bell curve, we are direct center, guys. Absolutely.
Well, normally on a startup, it's way down the low.
I know, right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. At the bottom with equity, right?
Yeah.
Well, is it like a stock thing or is it like just a regular job?
All of our employees get stock, and they don't get options. They actually get real stock, common stock
right.
in the company.
Okay.
Very
so
cool.
There you go. So you're looking for programmers.
Mm, absolutely.
There you go. We're clever programmers out there. If you want a job in Houston, home of big hats and big guns.
They can be remote too. So.
Oh, yeah.
Ah, yes. Right. There you go. Excellent. We'll put details down below where people can sign up, and we should start charging a commission, Chris.
No, come on. These guys, they offer their time. I mean, come on, man.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Okay. All right, freebie.
We'll give really big discounts to anyone who helps us hire.
There you go. Yeah. Coupon codes for boards, right?
Yeah. Awesome.
Chris Gamble's secret soup or coupon code.
There you go. Speaking of coupon codes, do you guys? This is the last thing I wanted to ask. I think Dave's. We should probably wrap this up eventually. You know, hour and a half so far. are you guys seeing? I mean, other than just the normal breaks, I always wonder, like, if CMs. I mean, you guys are CM-ish, right? I wouldn't say just CM, but Are you guys starting to be able to bundle enough, or do you plan to be able to bundle enough to start negotiating like larger scale discounts with the big distributors and manufacturers?
Yeah, that is definitely on our list. We're not there yet, but we're getting there pretty quickly. So
I'm always amazed, and I think we've talked about it on the show before, is just like to do so, you're still going to need to talk to a salesperson. Like for all of your code and all of your brilliance and, you know, like all this front end, back end API stuff, like you're still talking to Jimbo, the sales guy.
Well, that's how the house parts are so inexpensive. Is we buy them in bulk, so
yeah.
And we give the discount we were able to get, we pass that on.
Yeah,
and you know we have been, outside of just the distributors, we've been working with the manufacturers too to try to get the, you know, a better discount, you know, get them to get the discount for us through their distributors, since they're ultimately the source of this and they have a lot more sway than us. And we're finding that they are very amenable to that when we're providing value to their customers. So we have to give a little, take a little bit. You
know? Yeah, I'm always surprised that like when I knew I've kind of fallen out of favor with the folks in this area because I don't really make anything around here anymore. But like they always said, their best customers were like the sales guys I knew who were earning commissions were the guys who were in the manufacturers in town, you know, the manufacturer salespeople and the FAEs and stuff like that. They got a big chunk of their money from the actual manufacturing on the ground in Cleveland because, mm-hmm. you know, it's just like direct and they can tie it directly to that facility. So yeah, salespeople probably love and or will love you guys.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a part of it. And too, it's like, we're part of our house part model provides a lot of benefit back to their users as well, the manufacturer's users. And we found in some cases, they're really keen on the idea if they're commonly using a component that's very hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
We suddenly get a lot of help from them when we agree that we'll carry that as a stock house part.
Aha. Yep, it's your bargaining chip.
Suddenly they're like, you know what? Hey, if you guys are willing to carry that, we'll help you get a discount on this part from this distributor over here. So
they love the ability to schedule things. They just love it.
Yep, exactly.
Gets them all excited.
So people, if they go sign up right now for the service, I mean, it's just pretty much upload a bomb. They can go right away almost, right? I mean, like 15 days later.
Upload your design files and, you know, take a look through your bill of materials, make sure everything's correct, and hit order and go over there.
It is in beta. So
there'll be bugs. But if it's a pricing bug in your favor, well, that's the price you're paying.
Like in Monopoly.
Come back. Yeah.
Thank you in your favor. Right.
Well, thank you very much, guys. It's been awesome.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having us. I've really enjoyed this.
Oh, yeah.
We would love to talk to you guys again in the future, especially as you, you know, continue. I'm sure, this is going to do awesome. I'm sure it's already doing awesome, but yeah, this is a big deal, folks. If you didn't know, this is a big deal. Take it from me and Dave.
Do you have any direct competitors at the moment?
Right now, I mean, the closest we're going to get is going to be like Circuit Hub and SnapEDA. You know, again, for that experience on the upfront side, but we haven't seen anyone meet our one-off price yet.
I have not found out either.
Interesting.
Or has like a front end like we do and actually run the line.
Yeah,
at the same time.
At the same time.
But we do know that's coming, by the way. I mean, you can look at the market out there. The EMS companies know that they're behind right now on that user onboarding friction phase of the process.
Another bingo word, friction.
And onboarding, don't forget that.
Yeah, onboarding.
Yes.
Talking to my board today, so it's kind of... but they know that they have these problems getting new customers in the system, and they see us, they see Circuit Hub, they see SnapEDA, and I think we're probably... I took a look out there, we've probably got three or four more coming like that, which is like an instant, easy quote front end. And the manufacturers, the contract manufacturers see this, and I can guarantee you they're going to be building those interfaces over the next year or two here. You're going to start seeing that from other manufacturers like us.
Bully for us, Dave.
I know. Fantastic for us. You guys
awesome.
You guys might go out of business, but yay for us.
Oh, no.
Nah, they'll stay ahead.
I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah.
They're all doing great. You know, like it's... Yeah. Thank you for pushing them. You know, that's the main thing. They could get away with it for so long because it's like, oh, single board, you're not worth our time. And now it's gotten to the point where it's just, you know, there's a market for it. That's great. Right. Yeah, now there's software. Awesome.
Yeah, and they maybe still see the single board as not worth it, but that whole, like, you know, that instant upload your files, we'll quote your parts and everything, that's coming. That's coming from everybody here soon.
Gotcha. Very cool.
Good stuff. Thank you very much, guys.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
One last thing. Where do people send their software resumes and or hardware resumes if Parker's hiring as well?
Oh, to jobs@macrofab.net.
All right. I'll post a text link to that.
Why is it .net and not .com?
It was taken and they won't sell it.
Oh.
Bastards. Yeah, is it a squatter or is it a it's real a squatter. User?
Yeah.
Did you ever think, well, we'll just change our name because .com is everything?
No, it's not, Dave.
No. It is.
It used to be.
No, we looked at it and this is the name we wanted and eventually we'll get that .com.
I wonder if we open up another shop somewhere, we're going to be Macro Fabs.
Ooh.
Ooh. Registered .com now.
Yeah. All right, guys. Thanks again.
All right.
We look forward to trying out the service.
No problem. Thanks, guys.
See ya.
Thanks. See ya.